Welcome back to the second week of Four Quarters, Four Questions. And as always, I'm joined by Adam Collier. And Adam, let's jump right into it after what was a pretty dismal weekend for Penn State. Before we get into it, I just want to clue some viewers in on what's going on. Last week, I was drinking some Maker's Mark. Unfortunately, that bottle is no more. So this week, I'm back to the old trusty Miller Lite smoothies. And with that, I'll toss it over to Mr. Collier.
It's really good that you're drinking Miller Lite again. It really classes up the establishment, Jeff.
Hey, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, is my motto.
That's fair enough. I mean, we had a good run with your Miller Lite nonsense over the last couple months, so I guess it's a return to glory of some sort. For me, I'm drinking hello, everybody, since I'm just rambling on here. I'm actually drinking a Three Philosophers from the Omegang Brewery from Cooperstown, New York. Trying to class it up a little bit and make up for Jeff's shortcomings. So the first topic of today's Four Quarters, Four Questions, let's talk about the offense from the game against Ohio on Saturday. What do you think, Jeff?
All right, so this is clearly a game of two halves. They came out, and I was actually a little bit impressed. It was steady. It was solid. It was a little bit mistake-ridden, but the first offense under Bill O'Brien, I was content going into halftime. The first half had Matt McGloin throwing 26 passes, which was a lot. But at the same time, he completed 16 of them. He had decent yardage. He had he managed the game well. You know, he was hitting his slants. He was hitting his drags. He was hitting his running backs. And him and Allen Robinson seemed to be on an unbelievable connection. But then the second half obviously happened. And the wheels came off. He started going deep more, which I saw as the first piece of evidence that something bad was about to happen. Because in the first half, he wasn't looking to go long. And in the second half, it was almost two or three plays in a row at a clip that he was looking deep. His first progression wasn't available, and he would just start looking at who was running the go pattern. As for the rushing, Belton seemed to find some holes. He was a steady running back, but he carried the ball like it was, a loaf of bread on his way home after school. He was just running with it high, willy-nilly, which probably led to a fumble. And behind him, Derek Day, who was a beast, obviously, getting crushed in the head by a spearing Ohio defensive player and coming right back into the game. But at the end of the day, they got less than 100 yards, 92 yards rushing as a team. Belton just barely made it over 50 as the lead runner, only carrying it 13 times. It wasn't a great rushing effort from a team that in the past had based a lot of its success on rushing. And then receiving, again, it goes hand in hand with McGloin having a great first, not great first half, but a manageable first half. Allen Robinson was lighting things up. I was ready to order my Allen Robinson jersey. And I still might with a 9 for 97 day and 10.8 per reception. But, they cooled off at the end. They were missing some balls, a couple drops here and there. And it was just a tale of two halves. I really liked what I saw in the first, and obviously I didn't like what I saw in the second.
Yeah, I don't think that's unexpected. First of all, I think the offense came out kind of gangbusters. I think there was a lot of emotion, a lot of adrenaline, and I think that plays a significant role in it. I think a couple things. One, Matt McGloin played a very good game overall, I think. Interestingly enough, there were some complaints that the offense didn't adjust appropriately from the first half to the second half. I'm actually not sure I agree with that. What I think was happening, last week, Bill O'Brien was caught on camera talking about how, wow, these guys don't like to tackle, in reference to watching film of last year's Ohio Bobcats game. And so what I think he was doing in the first half, there was a lot of discussion today and yesterday and probably during the game threads, although I missed it. McGloin completed a lot of short passes, and his yards per attempt were something like 5.4, which a lot of people called atrocious. I think in a lot of ways that was by design, and it wasn't necessarily by design to compensate for McGloin's shortcomings, but I think a lot of it was by design to get the ball quickly out of his hand into the hand of playmakers where they could have some open space, make somebody miss, and take it to the distance. There were a couple of times where we were able to get the ball in the hands of our playmakers, where they made some plays. There were a couple times where they looked like they were this close to breaking it, you know, a fraction of an inch. But somebody would get tripped up or shoestring tackled or something like that. And so what I think happened between the first and the second half is O'Brien and his offensive staff may have seen, look, you know, we're not breaking tackles. You know, we're not evading defenders like we need to. The only one who was really able to do that was Allen Robinson, who played a fantastic game. And so maybe they tried to take a couple more shots downfield in the second half. Certainly they felt as though between the running game, which seemed to be producing yards in the first half, at least somewhat, and a quality short passing game, that things opened up. I mentioned in a comment today in response to somebody critiquing McGloin's performance and that he couldn't hit the deep ball. First of all, we've seen Matt McGloin hit the deep ball multiple times. I don't think this should even be an argument anymore. This has happened numerous times over and over and over again. The problem, as always, with throwing the deep pass is that it is a low probability completion. And so if you take three shots, there's no guarantee that you're even going to hit one. But if you hit one, you'll probably hit for big yardage. Matt McGloin is not Tom Brady. We all know that. Matt McGloin can be a good college quarterback. I'm not sure where he is on that spectrum now. But I think people are expecting him to be perfect, and they've created this vision where anytime something goes wrong in the offense, it's Matt McGloin's fault. I don't think that's true at all. I think he played a fine game. I think much more worrisome is the fact that we don't appear to have any kind of consistent running game, despite the fact that Bill Belton is a perfectly acceptable size for a consistent college running back, but has very little experience in that area. I thought the offensive line looked relatively decent this week. Certainly, they were opening holes better than they had in season openers in some time, especially considering that they have very little experience coming back comparatively. You know, I thought I saw a lot of signs of life out of an offense that was dreadful, to be blunt, last year. This team looks much better prepared. McGloin, for all his physical shortcomings, is absolutely in complete control of the line of scrimmage. He appears to be the guy calling the plays at the line. That can only be a good thing as far as I'm concerned, because at least it gives us the opportunity to audible out of obviously ridiculous plays. I think the offense has a lot of potential, and O'Brien is clearly a creative play caller. If you remember, there was one play, Robinson was lined up as a single receiver, and he was put in motion and put into the backfield, and we essentially were running a full house backfield. It was maybe Robinson and three tight ends. McGloin play actions, and Robinson sneaks out into the flat from the backfield, catches a perfectly placed pass, and runs for 15 yards. It was very creative. It was something that you certainly haven't seen out of a Paterno offense in quite some time. I think he has a lot of potential. Unfortunately, we had terrible field position basically all day, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about special teams, because frankly, starting with the ball in the 10, the 11, the 15, the 20, and the 25, no matter how many times, you can't expect a college team to drive 80 yards and put together workmanlike drives every single time they have the ball. It's just not going to work.
Right. And the special teams was special. I use that term loosely because at times they showed flashes of greatness, but at times you were banging your head off a wall, and I'll get to the obvious point of that in a minute, but the kicking game of the special teams, notably the kickers, Butterworth, he looked like he could get a good punt off if he really worked at it. He shanked one or two. He could be the replacement of Anthony Farrah. Sam Ficken was, he made his extra points, okay, but on kickoffs, the ball was consistently landing, well outside of the end zone, where it shouldn't be. They were getting great field position, and it's tough to ask the defense to stop a solid Ohio offense with the field position they were getting. Now, the obvious blunder that everybody saw from the get-go in the special teams was Gerald Hodges back on returns, and I don't know what the hell Bill O'Brien was thinking.
Can you seriously explain to me what the hell he was doing? I really don't understand it. I'm trying desperately not to be overwhelmingly critical of this new staff. I think we have to expect, for as good as O'Brien has been as the face of the program and the guy on ESPN, and as good as he's been in the press conferences and all of that kind of thing, he's still a rookie head coach and he's going to make rookie mistakes. That being said, you know, look, you see Gerald Hodges back there the first time, and I was in the north end zone, and I saw him back there. And I turned to my dad, who was sitting next to me, and I was totally confused. And I said, what the hell is he doing back there? And we both kind of shrugged and said, okay, you know, maybe he knows something we don't. Maybe he's trying to be 2 feet by half. Maybe he'll be a blocker. He's essentially going to function as the lead blocker for Amos back in the backfield, you know, and Adrian Amos will be the one who fields every kick, and then Hodges acts as the lead blocker on the wedge, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And then he fields the ball multiple times. And it became very apparent to me that, you know, Belichick has all these weird, quirky things that he does to throw people off guard. But the difference is that he sees players who are very versatile and are able to use that versatility effectively. I mean, I think the best example is Danny Woodhead, who, by the way, I see a lot of in Derek Day, which is really the first time I've ever paid attention to him running. But, you know, Hodges returning kicks is insane. He's 250 pounds. This is never going to work.
No, you're right. And I don't understand why he was there, and many fans don't as well. Only Bill O'Brien and his coaching staff and the decision makers know what they were doing. And clearly they realized their mistake 30 minutes too late, or whenever it was that he was finally pulled for Belton, and thus ends the great Gerald Hodges as a kick returner experiment. And unfortunately it was 30 minutes too late, because, you know, that first fumble led to 3 points for Ohio, and yeah, that didn't make up the game, but at the end of the day, you have to ask yourself, you know, could Bill Belton back there have made it easier for the Penn State offense, given them a better return, given them better field positioning, not lost that fumble and turned that drive into positive points as opposed to points for Ohio. But, you know, getting back to the offense, I think they'll rebound somewhat. They're still in a state of finding their identity. You brought up the offensive line. I think they did a very good job. They were underrated going into the season. I still think, despite all the problems on offense that happened in the second half, they maintained. That left side of the offensive line looks very good. I'm very excited to see what that brings in the future with Donovan Smith, a redshirt freshman on the left tackle, and Miles Diffenbach, a redshirt sophomore on the left guard. Yeah, that's going to be solid protection for McGloin and quarterbacks to come in the next couple of years. So I'm happy with the way they played. It's just the rest of the team offensively just wasn't consistent for 60 full minutes, and that's what they need to be.
Yeah, I guess that's not surprising either, given the fact that we're replacing a large volume of starters and putting in a very complex offense. I think you can expect that they won't be very consistent. I'll tell you what I would like to see a little bit more of next week, and maybe this is just wishful thinking, considering the kind of coaches we have, but that power running game, you know, you don't know how much you miss it. I mean, I do, because I love the power running game. So I guess I knew how much I would miss it immediately. But, you know, Mike Zordich has a place in this offense. Curtis Dukes has a place in this offense. When you need to grind out yardage, that would have been perfect in the second half. You know, let's try and pound the ball. We're bigger, we're faster, we're stronger than Ohio. Yeah, maybe their quarterback is very good. He causes us a lot of problems. You know what? We got to keep him off the field. So, and the way to do that is not necessarily by running Bill Belton and Derek Day in single back sets. You know, if this offense is going to be multiple and scheme to whatever advantage that, you know, if we're going to be dependent on, you know, comparing our offense to the defensive team we're facing, how about lining it up and running right at them? You know, the first play of the game, we ran a power eye for 8 yards. It seemed pretty effective then. I feel like we could have used it a little more in the second half.
I guess it's different when you're running it on first and 10 as the first play of the game when, versus when you're running it third and one after completing, you know, two decent passes, but only getting, obviously, 9 yards. And that seemed to be the problem that they had in the first half, is that Allen Robinson would catch a great 5, 6, 7 yard out. Bill Belton might get one more yard here or there, or a combination therein. And they would always be just 1 or 2 yards short. It was always third and one, third and two, third and three. And it seemed like if they could just sustain a drive, they could have put more than the 14 that they did on the board. And that, you know, that was somewhat concerning, but I thought at halftime that, oh, you know what, this 14-3 lead is going to be sufficient. We'll come out, we'll add on a little bit, maybe let Ohio have a touchdown here or there. But, it, you know, they just came out flat in the second half, and Ohio just, they kept going. It wasn't that Ohio got any better, it's just that Penn State kind of regressed a bit, and they stopped playing the football that had been working for them in the first half.
You remember a couple years ago, the 2008 Iowa game. In the first half, we were knocking on the door 4 or 5 times, and we came away with, what, 9 points or something along those lines?
Right.
And I don't remember the specifics, but it was a low amount, right? And you always felt, you know, we left so many points on the board. That's how I felt about this game. This game should have been 21 or 28 to nothing at the half. Fumbling the ball at the 20, you know, getting tackled on at the 10-yard line on a punt return and forcing the defense or forcing the offense to try and drive 90 yards for a score, which screwed up field position for the rest of the half, frankly. The fumble near the end zone, the Gerald Hodges muff punt that led to 3 points. You know, these are all issues that prevented the offense from doing maximum damage and really probably exhausted the defense to some in some respect. And I feel like this game was imminently winnable. You know, Ohio's a good team. This is a game we should have won. And maybe this team in November wins this game handily, but this team in September really needed a more consistent performance to beat Tyler Tettleton, and that just didn't happen.
No, you're absolutely right, and maybe you're right. In November, when this team finally finds its stride, and Bill Belton is finally an every down back carrying it more than 13 times a game, and Matt McGloin can scale back the 48 passes, or maybe Bill O'Brien is the one that makes that decision. And he manages maybe 35 passes, but manages them well, as opposed to hitting the deep ball or trying too hard to get out of third and five. Maybe then they win, but this offense that was on the field on Saturday, you know, they're not going to win that game 8 times out of 10. Unless they play the first team or the first half offense for the entire game, it's just they were inconsistent way too long. And they have the athletes to make the plays, but they just couldn't put it all together for 60 full minutes.
Yep, agreed. So the bell signals our next topic. What do we have on tap, Jeff?
So obviously with the talk on offense, let's switch it over to defense. So same question. What do you think? How did you feel about the way the defense came out and played?
All right, I have 3 distinct thoughts on the defense. Some of which I know people will agree with, and some of which, just from discussion today, I know that people absolutely will not agree with. The first is, this game clearly changed on the bobbled interception, turned tipped interception, turned touchdown play. That series of plays. I was there, the entire stadium was deflated, the team was deflated, and it almost looked like they were just waiting for the other shoe to drop when that happened. And when it did, it took everybody out of the game for a good 20 minutes, which in college football and a close game is a killer. That ball, oddly enough, I don't remember if Ben mentioned it or not, but the best thing that Stephen O'Bank could have done is fall down on that play, because Morris was flying in like a bat out of hell from center field, waiting to pick that pass off and there was no one in front of him had he caught that pass and run it all the way back to the end zone. The real missed opportunity on this drive was obviously the Olanian bobbled interception at the line of scrimmage, which leads me to my second point, which is that for all the talk about Ted Roof's deficiencies over the last several days, they had Tettleton rattled when he was in the pocket for any amount of time longer than a brief two or three step drop and a quick release. Anytime he held the ball, we had pressure on him. We had him out of his element, and he forced a bunch of throws. There were several throws that should have been intercepted but were not, including two down the sideline, which I think were deflected. I think one by Morris and one by somebody else. I can't remember off the top of my head. Maybe Willis. And I think I said Morris before. I meant Willis was coming flying in and ready to take the ball the entirely the opposite way. There were a lot of complaints about the defensive line not getting any pressure. You know, it's pretty hard to get pressure when somebody's just dropping back, releasing the ball within 2 seconds and trying to, you know, running this quick ball control offense. I thought they did a decent job. I thought Roof's defense worked really well for most of the game. In fact, throughout the entire game, Ted Roof's defense, which has come under significant heat over the last several days, gave up two actual scoring drives, one of which, the third of which was an entirely fluke play. I thought the defense, all things considered, was relatively effective. The only time that I thought it was really a problem was actually the biggest moment of the game, which was, you know, they get the ball with 9 minutes left, they're up 17-14, and you figure, okay, we probably have two possessions left in this game. Let's get a stop, let's get the ball back, let's see if we can score. If not, let's get another stop, we'll get the ball back, and we'll see what happens. Instead, they take 9 minutes off the clock, convert multiple third downs, and we stayed, I don't even want to say we stayed aggressive. We continued to blitz. This was not an aggressive defense on that final drive. In fact, what we ended up doing was doing the worst combination of the bend but don't break that Tom Bradley and Joe Paterno were famous for, and the super hyper-aggressive blitz package set up by Ted Roof. You had a defense that was consistently rushing six guys, coupled with soft play by the corners, which led to multiple times on third and three, Tyler Tettleton dropping back and then completing a slant pass across the middle from where whichever linebacker happened to be blitzing at the time. And when they needed 3 yards, they got four. And they did it multiple times throughout the rest of the drive. And instead of getting the ball back with 6 minutes left, we got the ball back with 2 minutes left, down 10. And that destroyed us.
Yeah, I think you're right. Two things I'll say. One, in defense of Ted Roof, is that they came out and they played his scheme. I mean, he stuck to his guns. And it worked when it worked. And I know that's kind of a almost a Paternoism, but when they were getting pressure to Tettleton, yes, they were rattling him. However, the not in defense or in opposition of Ted Roof was Tettleton had way too easy of a time to take a three-step drop, hit a slant, and boom, 7 to 10 yard gain right there, and that killed us on any number of crucial plays. I think in the time that it's taking me to state this comment, Tyler Tettleton has hit three more slant patterns. I mean, it was mind-numbing, and I was watching the reaction from the fans in the stands, from people in comments, from Twitter. Everyone was just wondering why the heck there was no coverage, why was there no pressure, where's this aggressive cornerback play that's supposed to stop this? I mean, the front seven was, when they got pressure to Tettleton, or when they were asked to bring blitzes and pressure him, it's like the other guys forgot where their assignments were, or there was just gaping holes in this aggressive scheme, and that is going to get you burnt every single time as long as you have a competent quarterback in the back.
Yeah.
There has to be somebody covering the back end. If Marty's going to blitz off the weak side and there's a guy that's easily picking that up and running a quick slant, you know, there should be somebody picking up behind Marty. Now, I know that there's not enough players on the field to pick everybody up if you blitz extra players, But you know, you have to have contingencies. How many times did you see the slot receiver run a quick slant? Or Maudy coming off one edge or someone else off the other and Tettleton hitting the running back in the flat and him running for an extra 15 yards after catch. It was frustrating as all get out to watch that happen.
Yeah, I think a couple things. The first thing is you're right about the coverage, and I think that's the most frustrating part of it at all. Look, if you're going to commit to an aggressive defense, then commit. This defense worked. I don't know. Sometime this afternoon on one of the threads in one of the fan posts, I threw out some very specific stats about Blankenship in the running game. And for the first three quarters, they basically held Blankenship in check. You know, the vast majority of his runs were for 3 yards or less. And the vast majority of those runs that were 3 yards or less were actually runs for 2 yards or less. That was very effective. Tettleton, I don't know that he looked fantastic until the fourth quarter. I thought that the defense did a fine job of reining him in to a certain extent. The problem is that Tettleton is a good quarterback, and they ran a scheme that was specifically designed to circumvent whatever interesting blitz combination that you come up with. The whole purpose of running a ball control defense, a ball control offense, is to negate the pass rush by getting the ball out quickly and having a smart quarterback who can find a receiver who's open in the spot where one of your linebackers is blitzed. If you're going to blitz, it probably would have been beneficial to do some kind of zone blitz. And what I thought would have been really helpful on the last drive, instead of blitzing six, why don't you rush two? But, you know, alternate what two guys that is. Maybe blitz Maudy and a defensive tackle. And meanwhile, let our super athletic defensive ends, like Sean Stanley and C.J. Olanian, play in a shallow zone right behind where the line of scrimmage would be and get their hands up and invade the passing lanes while playing press coverage on the outside. That way, Tettleton has to either A, wait until somebody gets open, or B, take a shot downfield. And you know what? If he beats you then, fine. You gave it your best shot, and Tettleton was just better than you on that play. But instead, they kept giving him yards. And it was driving me crazy. And on replay, it drives me even crazier. That was terrible. It was a terrible strategy. But I think, and people aren't going to like this either, what that really belies is the lack of depth that's on the defensive side of the ball. And not just in the defensive secondary. You know, you have freshmen making the three deep at defensive tackle. I, frankly, if you look at the linebacker too deep, it's a real concern. You know, Naeem Wortman saw significant minutes at middle linebacker on Saturday. Mike Hull came in place of Gerald Hodges for a little bit, and he looked okay but struggled in passing situations. I don't know that this defense has enough bodies to play the kind of aggressive scheme for four quarters that we'd like to see them play. In fact, I don't know that this defense has enough bodies to play the kind of defense that Tom Bradley used to play, and that's a direct indictment on the previous coaching staff. And honestly, this is the best it's going to be for a number of years, and that's a really big problem. I don't see this going very well, to be quite honest with you.
Yeah, it's going to be a struggle, because you could chalk as much of this up to first game jitters, both as a team and as a head coach, as you can. But when you look at it, it was not a great performance all around. I mean, Tettleton hit roughly 75% of his passes, 325 yards, two touchdowns. Blankenship had over a buck, 109 rushing. They added another touchdown for Tettleton on the ground. You know, you're not going to be able to survive when you're putting up those kind of numbers, especially in Big Ten play, because the way the offense was playing, they just weren't going to put points on the board. No, the offense could come around and support the defense in what would be the weirdest change of pace for Penn State. But this defense that we've built ourselves upon for the past million years, and especially the front seven, who was supposed to be the strength, because all front seven were, you know, they weren't all starters returning, but they all had some game experience. Everyone knew the defensive secondary was going to be a challenge, but they weren't really tested because they weren't needed to be tested. Tettleton was perfectly content with hitting the quick slant, the quick out. He didn't need to hit the 15 to 20-yard passes because he was given the 5 to 10-yard passes. And that, like you said, that just it just blew my mind, and it was frustrating. And something has to change, be it Ted Roof scheming or Ted Roof himself, which many fans are already calling for. Well, you know, that didn't take long, but you know they obviously have to game plan differently for a team that's markedly better, in my opinion, the Virginia Cavaliers coming in next week.
Yeah, you know, I think two things. One is that Blankenship isn't a terrific running back. I think he averaged something like less than 3.5 yards a carry, which is actually a very good number. The problem is that he had 50, and in his first three quarters, he was averaging what I imagine to be far less than that, and his longest run was 10 yards. In the last quarter, he gained 50 yards, including runs of 12 and 10 yards. I'm doing this from memory, so if somebody has a correction, feel free to put it in the comments. He had runs of 12 and 10 yards and significantly bumped up his yards per carry average. And the only explanation for me is that this defense, which had looked pretty good defending the run for most of the game, was completely gassed because of the lack of depth. And that's the real concern for me going forward. That being said, what I'm really tired of hearing already is, well, Tom Bradley's defense would have won this game. Tom Bradley's defense got smoked by Case Keenum last year. And I realize that Case Keenum is a significantly better player, probably, than Tyler Tettleton, although we don't know that for sure. But what I know is that these are the kinds of quarterbacks that give us trouble. And I think going forward, ideally, you know, Virginia runs a much better, tighter offense, a much more traditional offense. And so does, for the most part, the rest of our schedule, with the exception of Navy. Which runs a completely different offense to anybody that we've seen so far, that I don't think the spread offense is going to be as big of a problem for us moving forward. So hopefully this is the first and last time that we'll have these kinds of issues, because I don't think we'll be seeing a quarterback as talented as Tettleton was for the rest of the season.
Yep, I agree. And at the end of the day, Tom Bradley or Ted Roof, you know, they weren't the ones out in the field making the miscues, so... you can say which defense would have been better or worse, but you know Tom Bradley wasn't the one that dropped that ball in his hands like C.J. Ohlanian did. Tom Bradley wasn't the one that was missing tackles. Ted Roof wasn't the one that tipped the ball to the Ohio wide receiver and so forth. Anyway, let's get that bad taste out of our mouths and let's move on to some halftime action. Clear the errors. What's our topic today, Adam?
All right, our topic today for halftime is another sports topic. We're going off the TV function for a little bit. But I want to hear your thoughts on Tiger Woods, because I, as full disclosure, I've been a golfer for basically my entire life. I am and have been a massive Tiger Woods fan, despite the scandal that has engulfed him over the last several years, for my entire life. There's always a question as to whether Tiger is back. I'm curious what you think, given his finish this week at the Deutsche Bank Classic, where he finished third to Rory McIlroy and Jeff Uthiesen.
You know, I also, in full disclosure, have been a huge fan of his. His personal life is his personal life, and it obviously affected his game. And I didn't get to see the final round too much, although I saw the 18th green with Louis and Rory. But Tiger, you know, it's tough to say, is he back? Was he ever gone? Yeah, he was gone for, you know, arguably a year, maybe a little bit more. But he's ranked third in the world. I don't know what he's re-ranked after this week. I have to assume it's at least still third, if he didn't move up.
Yeah, I think that's true as far as I can tell.
But he's still a great golfer. He just can't seem to close. And the running joke this year, for the big tournament at least, has been his weekend play. Because... for at least three of the majors that I can think of, he was right in the thick of it going into Saturday and then just crumbled like a house of cards. So, you know, I'm still a fan of his, although I'm also a fan of Rory. So it's kind of, you know, I'm looking good either way. Maybe I'm a bandwagon, maybe I'm a front runner. I don't care, but I like good golf, and I too am a golfer. So I like to root for those guys.
I'll tell you what, Rory's doing it right. Two majors, some big wins this year, really coming into his own, dating a beautiful woman. He's also an elite-level athlete. Tiger being back really depends on what you consider back. Is he back to the Tiger of, you know, 2000, where he was just dominating the competition from pillar to post?
Well, of course not. It's 12 years later.
I mean, he's older and somewhat injury-ridden, and he just doesn't have that kind of ability. That being said, he's really rebuilt himself into one of the best golfers in the world yet again, and I'd still take him on any given Sunday, frankly, to use a football term. I think he's still has potential to win multiple majors, but he needs to get his head right. He actually played really well Sunday, put himself right back in contention. McIlroy's got that killer instinct. Maybe he looks a little bit, I'm never going to admit that he's the new Tiger or whatever you want to call him. He's missed far too many cuts to be considered that right now. But he's got that killer instinct. And when he plays well, he plays really well, and he's almost unbeatable. But Tiger played well, and I think it's only good for the game to see him play well and see him match up against these young guys, and I hope that continues.
Yep. All right, let's move on. Third quarter question. Let's get right to it. We've covered Ohio, so let's look forward now. Virginia Cavaliers, our opponent du jour on Saturday. We head to, where the hell do they play? Charlottesville? Is that what it is?
Charlottesville, Virginia.
So I've never been there. I don't know if you've ever been there, but what are you looking for? What do you think the Cavaliers are going to bring for us?
Charlottesville is supposed to be beautiful. I hope a lot of people get the chance to go. I won't be there, and I haven't been there, although one of my close friends is actually doing his residency there, a Penn State graduate. He'll be down there this weekend. I really like their coach. Mike London has been successful basically everywhere he's been, including his last stop at Richmond, where he won the 1AA or the FCS or whatever it was called at the time. The 1AA national championship, came to Virginia. He's been recruiting very well. Great academic institution, does things the right way, as we'd like to say. Had an interesting quarterback battle going on with two familiar names actually to Penn State fans. The first of which is Mike Rocco, who won the starting job. Rocco's father, Frank Rocco, played on the 1982 championship team at Penn State. Apparently his grandparents still live in State College. I remember he's been a Penn State fan ever since he was a little kid. Apparently, from what I remember at least, he was a quarterback who would have liked to have had an offer from Penn State, and there wasn't one to go around for him. He's a junior now. He's from the state of Virginia and obviously the starting quarterback for the university. His backup and a guy who will be hot on his tail will be former consensus elite level recruit Philip Sims. Sims is another quarterback from Virginia who signed with Alabama 2 years ago and was in competition with A.J. McCarron for the starting job last year. McCarron had won that job when they visited Beaver State. By the time they visited Beaver Stadium in 2011, and Sims, it's unclear as to why he transferred. I know that some people think that he transferred because he lost out to McCarron. Normally, that would involve him. That would involve him sitting out this year, and so there wouldn't have been any quarterback competition at all. But he was granted a waiver by the NCAA, and who knows, for God knows what reason, which is something that we'll get to in the fourth quarter. But he was granted a waiver by the NCAA, so he can play immediately. And apparently it was a pretty tight quarterback controversy, a quarterback competition in camp. And Rocco was just named the starter, I believe, in the middle of last week. They came out, they had a good game, coincidentally, against Richmond, a money game, I'm sure it would be referred to as. And now the Nittany Lions come in desperately needing a win in order to keep some faith alive, probably among the players and the fans.
Yeah, like you said, London, he's got their team on a roll. And unfortunately, he's a fantastic salesman, he's a fantastic recruiter. And I say unfortunately because Virginia lies smack dab in the middle of prime Penn State recruiting grounds. We've lost a few names to Virginia, as well as Maryland and other teams in the area. But some of the names you'll hear from on Saturday are Darius Jennings, a wide receiver, caught a touchdown pass last Saturday. Eli Harrell and Mike Moore, a couple freshmen that Penn State was after. Brandon Phelps, a sophomore, plays in the defensive back safety role. He could have been, you know, very helpful to our depth chart now. Kenan Severin, a wide receiver that was good friends with the New England guys from last year, Armani Reeves, Cam Williams, who ended up at Ohio State, and a couple other guys that are on the Virginia team that Penn State was really after. So this isn't the Al Groh years of old. This is a new Virginia team. This is somebody that, or a team that, that shouldn't be taken lightly, and I think it's going to be a battle. And a lot of people, after watching last week's Penn State team, feel like it's going to be a losing battle. And I really can't blame them, given the way that the two teams looked. Virginia with their massive blowout of, what was it, Richmond, and Penn State with their loss. The line at last blush was 10 to Virginia, so yeah, that's a tough road to hoe.
I haven't seen much of Virginia, admittedly. My understanding is that they run a pretty traditional offensive scheme. You're not going to see the read option. You're not going to see some crazy spread formations. They have a bunch of good running backs. So I think, you know, and similarly to the way they contained Blankenship for three quarters on Saturday, is the kind of thing they're going to need to focus on the run, rush the passer, and, you know, ideally, Rocco will be a much easier guy to rush than Pendleton was. Rocco had a pretty slow start last year. He really turned it around, ended the season on a really nice note through the last eight games or so. I think he threw something like 12 touchdowns and 5 picks in the final eight games, but ended the season with 13 touchdowns and 12 picks. So you can imagine what his first four games looked like. I think we got to stop the run, and I think we got to rush the passer, and I think those are the kind of things that a Ted Roos defense should theoretically be good at, particularly one with the kind of players that we have in our starting front seven. So hopefully, although I think Virginia is probably a better overall team than Ohio, hopefully this scheme plays more to the strength of our defense than Ohio's team did.
No, I think you're right. I think they play a similar type of offense. I mean, if you look at the numbers, they passed for, rushed for the similar amount of yards that Ohio did, and they did it in roughly the same proportions that Ohio did. So you're going to look at similar looks, and you better believe that Mike London is watching film and seeing what Ohio did and seeing that he can hit those quick slants to players like Darius Jennings, and he can, you know, as long as he can convince Michael Rocco to stay in the pocket for those three steps, even if with Mike Motti running at his face, you know, keep your composure and hit your players, hit your progressions, hit your reads, you know, he's going to have a successful day. What Penn State needs to do is really study that Virginia game and more so study last week's game and see what went wrong. Because of anything, I think they need to correct what happened last week more than they need to look forward to what's coming next week, because, you know, they're going to beat themselves before they're going to get beat, and they definitely beat themselves last week. So as soon as they can stop that from happening, they can look to what schemes are the Virginia players going to run at them, what is Mike Lennon going to throw at Bill O'Brien, knowing that he's a new coach, knowing that he still has kind of the butterflies. It's going to be a good game. Is it going to get to that 10 minus 10 line? I don't know. I can see anywhere from a 20-point swing. I can see Virginia winning by that 10. I can see Penn State winning by the same 10. So I'm looking forward to it for sure.
I have no idea what's going to happen in this game. I think Virginia is probably the better team, at least the more experienced team. Maybe not the most talented based solely on the starters that we have. By the way, we haven't mentioned Kyle Carter at all, which is shameful of us. Kyle Carter played a terrific game on Saturday. Really looked the part of that wide receiver, tight end hybrid. you know, an Aaron Hernandez type, if you want to compare them to the Patriots, which I guess we're going to do for now until the end of time. As a side note, completely off topic, but do you remember that play on Saturday where Carter catches the ball, is working around a defender, and then suddenly they call forward progress stopped and blow the whistle as he spins off a guy and sprints toward the end zone?
Vaguely, not off the top of my head, no.
I watched it again on replay, and I still have no idea what happened. So if somebody wants to keep me, somebody wants to fill me in as to why that was stopped in the comments, please do. Carter is a beast. I'd like to see him remain a top target, and I think it's going to be necessary to keep diversifying this offense in order to keep Virginia off guard. I wonder if we're seeing what Penn State will look like in several years. You know, London took over a team that was lacking in certain areas. He's a young, aggressive head coach and a very good recruiter. Obviously, he doesn't have the sanctions issue to deal with, but Virginia appears to be on the right track. And I wonder if this is what we can expect. You know, I think they're going to play tough, hard-nosed football. I doubt you're going to see anybody get blown out in this game. Certainly not Virginia. I think they're probably too good and well-coached a team for that to happen. So, you know, I'm wondering if this is the kind of team that we should expect to see in a few years.
Yeah, you're definitely right. They kind of look the same. They feel the same. And it's going to be a good game. It's away, so it'll be fun to see how the opposing fans treat a Penn State traveling team. Are they going to give them some modicum of respect because they know that these players themselves had nothing to do with the whole issues that surround the team, or are they going to be kind of the a-holes that you encounter elsewhere?
Something tells me the students who dress in shirts and ties still for the Virginia game will be less of the latter type of fan.
Right. No, I agree. I think they'll be all right.
Smart for that. At least that's what I hope. You want to give a prediction now?
I'm hard pressed to say it, but I'm gonna go with the Cavaliers by 6. Let's call it. I think right around 23-17 is going to be my prediction. I don't think Penn State is capable of scoring much more than what they did last week, unless a lot of things start clicking. And if the defense can get their stuff together, they can hold Virginia to some decent yardage and points, but I still think the Cavaliers come out on top.
Yeah, I like that too, or at least something similar. I think we're going to lose. Which I guess is pretty disheartening with me. I think we're going to lose. I think this team will look better than they looked last week. I think depth issues are going to show themselves yet again. I think Rocco has a decent day. Nothing as good as Pendleton did. I think McGloin has a good day, and the running game gets a little back on track, and the special teams play is actually much more competent. Let's go with something like 27-23 Virginia.
All right. All right, well, I think we got to head to the fourth quarter now, and I think we got time for just a couple quick hitters, which is what we're going to make the fourth quarter into in the near future. So, Adam, let's start with you. One of the teams that did quite well for Penn State this weekend was the women's volleyball team. They bested Stanford and Texas and are now ranked second in the poll behind, I guess it's Nebraska, the AVCA poll. Has Nebraska 1, Penn State 2, so some good Big Ten representation. Purdue, Minnesota, and Illinois also find themselves in the top 20. But as for Penn State, do you see this as maybe a national championship team, or is this just a good weekend?
Seems like another national championship type team for Coach Rose. This is probably the best performance of any team that we'll talk about on this podcast, whether it's a national football game, a Big Ten football game, Penn State, Virginia, Ohio, whatever. They came out and they bested Stanford, who I believe was 9th in the country, if I remember correctly, in 5 sets, including apparently a riveting 5th set, which had some people talking as though it was the best college sporting event that they'd ever seen. They come back Saturday after a heartbreaking loss to the football team with the fans kind of down in the doldrums, and they come back and they hammer Texas 3-0, just shut them out. Our own Kerry Green, who I saw after the game, was there, took some tremendous pictures of the event, and actually one of our large offensive lineman commentators was also happened to be at that game, cheering on the women's volleyball team. They look pretty good. Maybe they're as good as they, you know, as the team has been over the last several years. You know, I know it's early in the season, and the Big Ten provides a tough schedule and a tough road to hoe, but it seems to me like they have a chance.
No, I agree. And the team is young, which is very good with success. Micah Hancock is your Big Ten player and setter of the week. She is only a sophomore. Lacey Fuller played very well as a freshman, a defensive specialist. The rest of the team, McClendon, Scott, they have a lot of star power, and this team could go deep, especially having already faced two very strong teams in Stanford and Texas.
Is Russ Rose the best recruiter on campus?
Yeah, I would have said yes 10 years ago. I would have said yes 5 years ago, and I'll say yes now. He is routinely getting players that are, you know, just phenomenal at their positions, and he's not just doing it from from Pennsylvania. He's getting them from around the country. He's getting them from Wisconsin, New Jersey, California, Florida, Illinois, Pennsylvania. They're everywhere. He's everywhere, and they want to come to win.
Maybe O'Brien and Chambers should be taking some pointers from both Russ Rose and Cokeys Washington, who have had some terrific recruiting classes over the last several years. Quick hitter number two. Did you see any of the Big Ten this week? Did anybody impress you? Did anybody disappoint?
Unfortunately, I wasn't able to watch too much this week. I had a lot of family commitments, so I was unfortunately torn away from the television. But from the recaps that I've heard and from the clips that I've seen, Michigan State looks legit. Their game against Boise State on Friday with Le'Veon Bell looked like he's the real deal. He's going to fight for one of the top running back spots in the pretty deep running back heavy Big Ten. Michigan, I didn't know what to expect from them going up against Alabama. That was going to be a tough game no matter what. I did not expect Alabama to win as big as they did, but maybe they're not as good as many had originally thought. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to see very much of the rest of the team, so I'll let you speak to that. But, you know, the Big Ten, you know, they're going to get their wins. They're going to get their losses. I was happy to see that they got the big win on Friday night. But, you know, it's early in the season.
Yeah, I didn't get to watch too much, although I did get to watch a couple games. I got to watch Michigan State. I thought Andrew Maxwell was okay. But Le'Veon Bell was terrific, although I don't know that they'll be able to run him 40-some-odd times a game for the rest of the schedule. But Michigan State picked up a big win against a rebuilding Boise State team, which is clearly going to miss Kellen Moore and Doug Martin more than you would probably actually as much as you would expect him. You know, Iowa pulled an Iowa. They had a close game against a low division team. That seems to be their MO during the first or second game of the year. So I guess that's not too much of a surprise. Michigan just got hammered. I watched that game at Whiskers at the Nittany Lion Inn, most of it at least, for the first half, and then just walked out because it was that terrible. the game that surprised me the most was Wisconsin, which, you know, Danny O'Brien had a nice debut, very efficient. Looked like they were going to cruise to a win, and then suddenly out of nowhere, UNI drops 21 and then looks to be driving for the go-ahead score, but ends up blowing it. But Wisconsin looking a little bit vulnerable, I think, on week one. So who knows what that's going to be like from here on out, but, you know, I wouldn't feel too comfortable if I were them right now.
Right, and with that, we've got just a little bit of time left, so give me a very quick input on what you thought about the national scene outside of the big, and what teams surprised you, what teams you're looking at, what team do you think is going to end up on top at the end?
All right, so I watched the South Carolina-Vanderbilt game, despite the poor pass interference call at the end of the game. You know, Marcus Lattimore, who blew out his knee last year, just looked terrific coming back in his debut. And, you know, Steve Spurrier, looking like the elder statesman of college football right now, has finally learned how to run the football. Who knew? Whoever thought you'd see the day, but over the last several years, he's really turned into a guy who appreciates defense running the football, and it seems to be working out well for them. Unfortunately, Alabama also was in their league. And frankly, Alabama is far out of their league and maybe far out of everyone else's league. They have the best recruiter in college football paired with one of the top five most traditional programs in college football. And that goes along with the fact that the best recruiter in college football is also probably schematically the best defensive coach in college football. I honestly don't see how Alabama lose the game for the next 2 years. I really don't. Maybe I'm overreacting to Michigan this past year, but you know, after watching them against us for two straight years, watching them just dominate another good team in LSU at the end of the year last year, now watching them smack around a Michigan team that's probably going to be pretty good, they're just phenomenal. There's nothing else. There's no other way to describe them.
Yep, they're very good, and there's a pretty good team out west, but you know, we'll see what they can do if Matt Barkley and Robert Woods can keep it up with some coaches that everyone loves to hate, and Nick Saban and Lane Kiffin. And on that note, we will take you out. We were once again let in by a phenomenal theme song, and we'll be let out by pretty much Adam and I's theme song, because we are going to be friends forever. So long, everybody, and we'll see you next week.
All right, bye, everybody.